The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the technology department, and is entitled, Please Don't Make Me Download Another App, by Ian Bogost. Fifteen years ago, an Apple ad campaign issued a paean to the triumph of the smartphone. There's an app for that, it said. Today that message sounds less like a promise than a threat. There's an app for that. If only there weren't. Apps are all around us now. McDonald's has an app. Dunkin' has an app. Every chain restaurant has an app. Every food delivery service, too. Grubhub, Uber Eats, DoorDash, Chowbus, every supermarket and big box store. I currently have 139 apps on my phone. These include Maynard's, Home Depot, Lowe's, Joann Fabric, Deerberg's, Target, IKEA, Walmart, Whole Foods. I recently re-downloaded the Michaels app while I was in the Michaels checkout line, just so I could apply a $5 coupon that the register failed to read from the app anyway. Even when you're lacking a store-specific app, your apps will let you pay by app. You don't need to figure out, or remember if you ever knew, whether your gardener or your hair salon takes Venmo, Cash App, PayPal, or one of the new bank-provided services such as Zelle or Paze. It's enough to drive you crazy, which is a process you can also track with apps for your mental health, such as Headspace and Calm. Lots of apps are aiming to help you feel your best. My iPhone comes with Apple Health, but you might also find yourself with Garmin or Strava or perhaps Peloton, if you're into that, or whichever app you need to scan into your local gym, or Under Armour, a polyester shirt app that is also a jogging app. The MyChart app may help you reach a subset of your doctors and check a portion of your medical test results. As for the rest, different apps. The tree of apps is always growing, always sending out its seeds. I have an app for every airline I have ever flown, and in every place I ever go, I use fresh apps to get around. In New York, I scan into the subway using just my phone, but the subway app tells me which lines are out of service. For DC, I have a Smart Trip app. At home in St. Louis, I have a physical pass for the Metrolink, but if I ever want to buy a ticket for my kid, I need to use the Transit app. For hiring a car, I've got the Uber app, which works almost everywhere, but I also have an app for Lyft and Curb for taxis, just in case. Also parking. I have Parkmobile, PayByPhone, and one other app whose name I can't keep straight because it doesn't sound like a parking app. If you've got kids, you'll know they are the Johnny Appleseeds of pointless apps. An app may connect you to their high school, to their school for assessing their schoolwork, or connecting to their teachers. Only thing is, you might be assigned a different app each year, or different apps for different kids in different classes. It could be Class Dojo, Brightwheel, Blooms, or Talking Points. It could be ClassLink, School Status, or PowerSchool. The school bus might also have an app, so you can track it. And if your kid plays sports, God help you. A friend has an app, Sports Engine, that describes itself as the one app that does it all, and yet she has several more youth sports apps on top of that. Let's talk about The Office. Yes, there's an app for that. There are 1,000 apps for that. Google Docs has an app, as do Google Sheets, Slides, Mail, and Search. Microsoft is highly app-enabled, with separate apps for Outlook, Word, and Excel. Then, of course, you've got the groupware apps that allow you to coordinate with colleagues, such as Slack, Teams, Zoho, and Pumble, and the office infrastructure apps that your employer may be using to, you know, make your job easier. Workday, Salesforce, Notion, Zendesk, Jira, Box, Loom, Okta. And what about that, all the other apps I haven't brought up? The ones that now may be cluttering your phone. What about Duva, Nork, Ping Pong, and Genzillo? Those are not actually apps as far as I'm aware, but we all know that they could be, which is my point. Apps are now so numerous and so ubiquitous that they've become a form of nonsense. Their premise is, of course, quite reasonable. Apps replace clunky mobile websites with something clean and custom-made. They helped companies forge more direct connections with their customers, especially once push notifications came on the scene. They also made new kinds of services possible, such as geolocating nearby shops or restaurants and camera scanning your items for self-checkout. Apps could serve as branding, too, because their icons, which are also business logos, were sitting on your smartphone screen. And apps allowed companies to collect a lot more data from their customers than websites ever did, including users' locations, contacts, calendars, health information, and what other apps they might use and how often. By 2021, when Apple started taking steps to curtail the data harvest, the app economy was already well established. Smartphones had become so widespread, companies could assume that any customer probably had one. That meant they could use their apps to offload effort. Instead of printing boarding passes, Delta or American Airlines encouraged customers to use their apps. At IKEA, customers could prepay for items in the app and speed through checkout. At Chipotle or Starbucks, an app allowed each customer to specify exactly which salsa or what kind of milk they wanted without holding people up. An apartment building that adopted a laundry app spared itself the trouble of managing payments at its machines. In other words, apps became bureaucratized. What started as a source of fun, efficiency, and convenience became enmeshed in daily life. Now it seems like every ordinary activity has been turned into an app, while the benefit of those apps has diminished. Parking apps offer one example of this transformation. Back before Park Mobile and its ilk, you might have had to drop coins into a street meter. Some of those meters had credit card readers, but you couldn't count on finding one. Parking apps did away with those annoyances. They could also remind you when your time was up and in some cases allow you to extend your parking session remotely. Everyone seemed to win. Individuals, businesses, municipalities, and of course, the app-driven services taking their cut. But like everything, app parking grew creaky as it aged. Different parking apps took over in different places as cities chose the vendors that gave them the best deals. These days I use Park Mobile in some parts of town and Passport in others, a detail about the world I must keep in mind if I want to station my vehicle within it. The apps themselves became more complex too, burdened by greater customization and control at the user and municipal level. Sometimes I can use Apple Pay to park with Park Mobile, other times I can't. Street signage has changed or vanished. So now I find myself relying on the app to determine whether I even have to pay after 6 p.m. on a weekday. The app sometimes signed me out, then I have to use my password manager just to log back in. Or worse, my phone might have an offloaded which parking app I needed because I haven't used it in a while, such that I have to re-download it before leaving the car. Similar frustrations play out across many of the apps that one can or must use to live a normal life. Even activities that once seemed simple may get you stuck inside a thicket of competing apps. I used to open the Hulu app to watch streaming content on Hulu, an app equivalent of an old television channel. Recently, Hulu became a part of Disney Plus, so now I must watch Hulu via the Disney Plus app instead. When HBO introduced a premium service, I got the HBO Go app so I could stream its shows. Then HBO became HBO Max, and I got that app before HBO Max turned into Max, a situation so naughty that HBO had to publish a frequently asked question app about it. I'd like to think that this hellscape is a temporary one. As the number of apps multiplies beyond all logic or utility, won't people start resisting them? And if a platform owner such as Apple ratchet up their privacy restrictions, won't businesses adjust? Don't count on it. Our apocalypse is much too far along already. Every crevice of contemporary life has been colonized. At every branch in your life, and with every new responsibility, apps will keep sprouting from your phone. You can't escape them. You won't escape them, not even as you die, because, of course, there's an app for that, too. Today's second article comes from the health section. The Truth About Lithium May Never Come Out, by Shayla Love. Of the first three elements to appear after the Big Bang, only one is available to buy as a bath soak. The SADS Smashing Anti-Stress Bath Treatment, which comes in shiny silver packaging, lists lithium as an ingredient and promises to take users from weighted down to mellowed out. It's one of dozens of over-the-counter lithium supplements that claim to support a healthy mood. The metal is also an ingredient in Novos Core, a supplement marketed to target the 12 root causes of aging, plus in Life Extension, Extend Life, Life Link, Youngtivity, and Age Immune. The anti-aging entrepreneur Brian Johnson's essential multivitamin includes lithium too. I am on a 1 milligram daily dose, Johnson told me in an email. Lithium, in other words, has become firmly entrenched in the wellness industry's extensive library of supplements. But in crucial ways, it is unlike the other trendy products that dance across your Instagram stories. At higher doses, lithium is a powerful treatment for severe mood disorders, and preliminary evidence suggests that lower doses might improve well-being for people without mood disorders, too. The problem is, American companies have little business interest in finding out how effective it really is. If you put pure lithium into water, it will explode into crimson flames, but mixed with acids, lithium forms stable salts. Lithium compounds also dissolve uric acid, which doctors in the mid-1800s believed to be a cure of many illnesses. Physicians began using lithium to treat a wide range of ailments, including headaches, diabetes, asthma, indigestion, obesity, skin disorders, rheumatism. Walter Brown wrote in his book, Lithium, A Doctor, A Drug, and a Breakthrough. By the end of the century, lithium water was marketed as a patent medicine. In that era, patent medicines, trademark proprietary cure-alls, many of which contained alcohol or opium, were a popular alternative to going to the doctor. 7-Up was originally named Bib Label Lithiated Lemon Lime Soda, contained lithium citrate, and was marketed as a health tonic and a hangover cure. Sears sold Schifflin's Effervescent Lithia Tablets, which were marketed for a variety of health concerns, including gout. In 1949, lithium chloride, a table salt alternative marketed to people with heart conditions, caused an outbreak of lithium poisoning in which at least 2 people died. The FDA, which had already started cracking down on patent medicines, quickly banned lithium in food products. Later, researchers found that high doses of lithium can cause kidney failure, thyroid damage, tremors, and nausea. In 1970, the agency approved lithium carbonate for bipolar disorder. Today, it's also used off-label mostly for major depressive disorders. Then, in 1994, the FDA created the category of dietary supplements, which it does not evaluate, ushering lithium, mostly in the form of lithium orotate, back into a patent medicine-like gray zone. For decades, scientists have debated whether the lithium water craze had any truth to it, if low doses of lithium might benefit a larger population than people with mental health conditions, maybe even everyone. Some researchers think it's worth investigating whether lithium is an essential micronutrient, like calcium or magnesium, with a recommended daily minimum of some yet-to-be-determined amount. Lithium carbonate is typically given at 600 to 900 milligrams a day for mood disorders. We get minuscule amounts of lithium from foods such as grains, potatoes, tomatoes, and cabbage. Depending on where you live and what mineral deposits are nearby, your tap water may also contain lithium. A 2024 review paper led by Alan Young, a psychiatrist at King's College London, determined that most lithium orotate supplements on the market today contain a micro dose of 5 to 20 milligrams, and many have a trace dose of just 1 milligram. The sad smashing anti-stress bath treatment contains 127 milligrams of lithium orotate, but it's meant to be absorbed through the skin, not ingested. The effects of such low doses remain a mystery. Although a 2020 meta-analysis of studies from 9 countries, including the United States, found that higher amounts of naturally occurring lithium in tap water are indeed associated with lower suicide rates, studies from places such as Switzerland and the east of England have found no association. In a 2021 study of rural Argentina, places with more lithium in their tap water had more suicides. Martin Ploderl, a co-author of the recent Switzerland study, told me that his team has found a publication bias in study of lithium in tap water. Those with positive findings are more likely to end up in journals. Research into lithium's effects on dementia, Alzheimer's, and longevity also have been promising but inconclusive. A 2011 study of tap water data from Japan found that the more lithium in the water, the longer people lived. Lithium consumption has been linked to longer lifespans in flies, roundworms, and yeast, perhaps because it regulates molecules involved in metabolism and resistance to stress, Michael Risto, a medical researcher at Charité University Medicine Berlin, and co-author of the Japan study, said. A 2019 study found that bipolar disorder patients who take lithium have longer telomeres, a proxy for lower biological age, than patients with other psychiatric disorders. And a more recent study from Japan found that people who took lithium for mood disorders had lower rates of dementia than similar patients who did not take lithium. These data are compelling enough for Risto, who told me he now takes a low dose of lithium every day. Nasir Ghami, a psychiatrist at Tufts University School of Medicine, did not comment on his personal use, but told me, "I think it's beneficial in people who are middle-aged and older, who have any risk factors for dementia." To be really sure, randomized trials in humans are needed. Because lithium is an ancient element, however, it can't be patented. Only novel inventions are available for intellectual property protection. In order to obtain a patent, a company would have to come up with some different delivery method or other improvement. Pharmaceutical companies, which are regulated by the FDA, therefore have little reason to fund an expensive clinical trial, especially when cheap versions are already sold over the counter. But supplement companies have incentive to sell lithium over the counter without conducting rigorous research on its effects. 0 clinical trials for lithium orotate are currently registered in the U.S., despite its widening market availability. Scientists don't yet know whether lithium orotate supplementation would yield different results than lithium in tap water. Only 2 studies on such supplementation have ever been conducted in humans, one from 1973 and one from 1986. And they have small sample sizes and no placebo groups. Given that lithium does work for at least preventing bipolar disorder, it's a scandal that we don't know how it works, Young told me. If low-dose lithium remains akin to a patent medicine, Americans could miss out on understanding how and how well it works, and if taking it comes with any risks. In at least one case report from 2007, a woman took 18 tablets of a lithium supplement called Find Serenity Now at once and went to the hospital after vomiting. She was discharged with no other serious effects, but the risks of long-term use simply haven't been assessed. In the late 19th century, people such as Mark Twain and President Theodore Roosevelt traveled to Lithia Springs, Georgia, to drink lithium-rich water. The spring's appeal endures. You can order water from its website, which states, "Locals have always believed Lithia Spring water flows from the Fountain of Youth." Lithium predates human life, is extracted from stone, and can have a profound impact on a person's emotional life. No wonder it tempts our never-ending desire for some primordial cure-all, whether it be found in a groundwater spring or in our very own bathtubs. Atlantic staff writer James Parker, who wrote all of the short, humorous, and ode to articles that I have read previously, is now writing a weekly column entitled Dear James, in which he tackles a reader's existential worry. So today's article is from the Dear James series, and it is entitled Cold Showers Are Free by James Parker. Dear James, I have an unhealthy need to listen to health-related podcasts. The more I learn about my body, working out, and nutrition, the more I feel like I have control over uncontrollable things. A few problems with this. One, it does not really give me more control. Two, I only follow a fraction of the advice that I hear. And three, whenever I bring questions about the information to my actual doctors, they are not having it. Why do I continue to consume information that can't be applied to my real life? One guy says I should have some blood test, but my doctor says it's unnecessary. The entire world says I should be taking creatine, but my doctor says I don't need it. Another podcaster says I should use a fancy mattress cover that regulates my temperature. But who can spend thousands of dollars on that? It seems so out of touch with my reality, and yet I still keep at it. Why? Dear reader, the great Joe Strummer, who died, of course, much too young, once suggested that people who don't smoke should be prohibited from enjoying the artistic output of people who do, or did. But what's life for, after all? Obsessing about your mercury levels, counting calories, or staying up all night thumping fascists and singing, "The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in." On nobody's gravestone is it written, "He was very healthy." I can guarantee you one thing. Get that blood test, pop your creatine, lie down on your thermally intelligent mattress, and it still won't be enough. I think you already know this. You know that after only the briefest interlude of serenity, some podcaster or supplement salesman will have you twitching again, worrying that you need this or that. What a racket it's become, the wellness business. And forgive me for going off here, but I suspect that half of these guys are secret eugenicists. The non-gorgeous, the non-productive, the misshapen, and the lonely and the mad. They'd optimize them, or us, out of existence if they could. Why, you ask, why can't I quit these dudes? Because you're a human in the 21st century, and one of our possessing idolatries is health. The health of the individual, that is. Screw everybody else. We're stuck inside a myth of perfect, of private perfectibility. Also, it's good to feel good. You want to be strong. Perhaps like me, you need to manage your moods, and some of the stuff they talk about on these podcasts is helpful. Andrew Huberman's Psychological High, for example, the double huff of inhalation that he recommends for short-circuiting anxiety. I like that. It works. So here's my rule of thumb for the world of wellness. If you have to pay for it, don't. Cold showers are free. Meditation is free. Push-ups are free. Breathing is free. All of this vitality is at your fingertips right now, gratis. Create your own system. You know yourself and your body better than any podcaster does. Create your own podcast. Why not? You've already done the research. Fancy Mattress, my journey through wellness and out the other side. Your first guest could be your doctor. Wishing you real health, James. Now here's James Parker's An Ode to Squirrels from October of 2021. Why are you squawking at me, little messenger? Why are you up in that tree clenched, flicking your tail in a fury and showering me with imprecations? What have I done to upset you? Well, I think I know. You're vexed by my dullness. You see me lumping along the sidewalk, a blockish biped, with five sleepy senses and a private Truman Show rain cloud over my head, and my insensibility outrages you. I'm getting about 2% of what's going on, so you yell at me in croaks and leathery quacks. Wake up! Not that I'd want what you've got. Being a squirrel, having squirrelness, is an intense condition, a demanding condition, close resembling the last scatty spirals of a drug binge. I've seen you doing your pouching runs on your sudden stops. Threats, it seems, are everywhere. You rush, and then you freeze. You wait, breathless, and the whole scene around you sort of wobbles, caught in the blast radius of your vigilance. Then you rush again. It's exhausting. My dog is a threat, a real one. He'd kill you if he could, but he never can. You evade him always, corkscrewing around a tree trunk and dancing ninja-like along a fence. His reality is sharper than mine, and yours is sharper than his. This is why I appreciate you, squirrel, why I peer into trees and scan the rubbishy park for your pinched little unblinking face. I love the wildness with which you accompany my unwildness, the many spikes of terror and gratification that pierce your soul while I'm wondering if I left my car unlocked. Sorry, I found that last one very funny. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen the next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.